Why don't you paper zip high? Forget all your worries. Where troubled poets can't die. They're the meat of the story.
This is Steph here on Voices in the Valley. Last week we had so much fun interviewing Mercedes Toma Hansen about Ojibwe culture that she ended up filling the entire show. It was too hard to cut, and so we begin today with what would have been the second half of our show. Colleen Voldrika, author of Tree-Spirited Woman, shares her grandmother's experience growing up Ojibwe, and then Ojibwe expert James Vukelich and Gondola Romantica John Kirschbaum compare navigating the river on a canoe and a gondola. It's all about sharing our experience creating the season finale of the sci-fi series Hashtag Hush podcast, and we hope you'll enjoy the backstory in the month of August as we lead up to the release of Make Your Move, episode 9 of Hush, to be aired the first Saturday of September here on the Club 1220. And now, Colleen.
This is Steph. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to the second half of Voices in the Valley, and usually we have student hosts that interview our guests. But today we're breaking format a little bit and keeping Dina in the mix.
Oh, yeah.
We managed to convince her to stay for the second half of the
show. Wouldn't have missed it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in part, for many reasons, but in part because Dina's children have got Native American heritage.
Yep.
Specifically, we think, potentially
we
Ojibwe.
Think. Potentially.
Yes.
Qualifiers.
Yes. Well, and that's a whole interesting thing in and of itself that our guest here with us today, Colleen Voldrika, can share about because despite her blonde hair and her blue eyes, she also has Ojibwe background, and you knew that, but you didn't find out the stories about that until a little bit later. So after I introduce you officially, Colleen, then we'll delve into that. But I have to do the official introduction where I give your bio because it is so impressive. Colleen is, don't you love how bios always say about the way? Colleen is an official Chippewa, otherwise known as Ojibwe tribe member of the Pembina Band. Did I say that correctly?
You did.
All right. From the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, inspired by her teachings of her Native American family, she carried that wisdom forth into a book that if you were to go on the YouTube channel, you would see called Tree-Spirited Woman. It's a magnificent read. I loved it. I think most people sit down and read it all in one fell swoop because once you start, you just cannot put it down because it truly is a book that shares much wisdom and you just want to know how this relationship with the wise woman and this woman who goes into the woods, how it progresses and what happens. So anyways, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that later because first, what I want to do is begin discussing your journey, finding out about your Ojibwe heritage. Because if I'm understanding correctly, your grandmother lived with you up until you were 16 years old when she passed away.
Correct.
And you knew that she was from the Ojibwe tribe, but she never spoke about it because it was too painful to revisit some of that background and that heritage. So could you speak on that a little bit?
Yes. My grandmother was from White Earth. Her and her sisters, when they were young, they were taken from their home up in Manoman, which is in northern Minnesota, and they were taken down to Pipestone, which is in southwestern Minnesota, and they were to become Americanized. My great-grandmother was Ojibwe, or Chippewa. We never said Ojibwe, we always said Chippewa.
Okay.
And my great-grandfather was French-Canadian, but he was part Sioux, or part Dakota, and we didn't know much about his heritage other than he always just said French-Canadian. My grandmother, when I would talk to her about that, she had a picture and she would say, this is my basketball group. And now, Grandma played basketball on White Earth. And I have the only picture of my grandmother is in 1917 and it's her basketball team. Now I laughed because Grandma was like 4'9". Okay. So I'd say, Grandma, how did you play? What was this about? But when I would say, Grandma, what was it like? And she would say, Colleen, it just was not good. It was bad. It wasn't good. Hmm. So she would never talk about it. However, it was very important. The only thing she did tell me is she put us on the Indian rolls. When I was born and a number of my cousins were born, and some of my siblings, you had to be registered if you were Native American. I was given an allotment number, and I am on the White Earth Pembina Band. I am a registered White Earth tribal member. Mm-hmm. My grandmother always said, someday, Colleen, you will be paid for my land. Because when they were taken to the boarding schools, the way I understand it, a couple of her older sisters were older, and somehow they got to keep their land. Everybody on the reservation was given an allotment of land.
Okay.
But my grandmother and four of her sisters, I know their land was taken from them or signed over by her parents or something when they went to the boarding schools.
Okay.
So they lost their allotment of land. All right. So I do know that much. And I know that grandmother didn't talk about it, but was very, very important that we were put on the rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her comment. Someday you will be paid for my land.
So she never talked or shared any stories about the boarding school and her experience there?
Never. It was just a bad time.
Okay. But then, After she passed away,
and my mother passed away, it was not very many years ago, actually. It was probably only about 4 or 5 years ago. I met with my mother's first cousin who lived up 7 miles from the Canadian border. Three of my grandmother's sisters lived in northern Minnesota. Two of them owned resorts, and they stayed up there near the reservation, and this is where they grew up. So the kids hung around with the natives, and they did all first cousins, so their experiences were different. Aunt Delia would talk about stories. She would tell her stories because she was living still the culture. And she would tell Arlene and the kids what happened in the boarding schools. And I heard some very interesting, funny school stories. And that was actually the first time that I realized Grandma was taken to down to a Pipestone. I always thought they were in White Earth. So I did not realize that until a few years back. But Arlene said that Aunt Delia and Aunt Nora, and they would laugh and they would say, oh, the three sisters that lived in the cities, they were the city Indians, because they did not admit their Indian heritage other than they put their families on the rolls. But they didn't talk about it because they lived here in the cities. It wasn't the thing to do. You didn't want people to know that you had Native American in you at all. So Grandma would never talk about it. And so I learned a lot from that interview. And Arlene, the stories she shared, and that got me interested. So I contacted the Bureau of Indian Affairs to try to get the records from 1913, 1909, and, you know, the times that they were there. And I got some of the records, but my grandmother didn't have much said about her, and the other sisters had more. My Aunt Delia, when she was telling the stories, there was a lot of her in these papers because she was, quote, the hellraiser. She did things and got in trouble. But she protected the sisters, one of the youngest sister, because Aunt Hattie wet the bed. And if she would wet the bed, then she would get punished. So Aunt Delia would stay up and come and wake her up and make sure she didn't wet the bed. And so there's all these stories, and they couldn't allow to sleep in the same areas because, you know, getting rid of your language. So grandmother lost her Chippewa language and her French. She spoke a little of both early on. And then she only had the English. They were raised in, you know, Catholic, and Catholic was still always important then to my grandmother, regardless of what she went through.
Right.
Her faith was always somewhat important, but she always did say, God doesn't care where you go. Just go.
Just be somewhere.
Just go somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
She didn't care.
So are there any other stories that you learned from Arlene and the rest of your family that might be interesting to share?
You know, one of the things that they had to do is they would get old rags and old things, and they would have to braid them like for rugs. And they would get, the nuns would, or the schools would get paid, and they would send them off. Well, when Aunt Delia got in trouble, she had to do a lot of braiding. Well, she ended up going in, and she didn't really braid. She stuck other stuff in there throughout it so that it looked like there was this whole thing.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But when they sent it off, there really wasn't any of it in there. Because it was her way of getting back.
Oh, her passive-aggressive.
Her passive-aggressive. Now, so that was, you know, just a few of the things, some of the things. But not much about my grandmother. You know, it was more about what Aunt Delia did, not what Aunt Nora and the rest of them did.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Tree-Spirited Woman.
All right.
And before we do that, though, I want to read a
quote from the Midwest Book Review because it's just charming what it has to say about your book. The Midwest Book Review gave Tree Spirited Woman a 5-star review. Congratulations. That's pretty impressive. And then said, "The intensely beautiful story of a guiding friendship with a wise and mystical woman who shares her universal message about the value of letting go, trusting in love, valuing personal relationships, and accepting the inevitable phenomena of death within the world around us." Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty neat. Well, the book has won many, many awards, and I was about to name them all, and then I was like, you know what? Just out there, it's won basically every award in
it's
this
a really
category
good book.
That you can win. So what I couldn't help but honing on, because it was a really interesting tidbit, is that it was included in the 2012 Celebrity Gift Bag.
Wow.
Get this, Dina, honoring Academy Award nominees and presenters in Beverly Hills.
Wow, that's amazing.
How cool is that?
It is really cool. Yeah. And now I have to tell you, it's good and it was great. I don't know if anybody ever read it or how it ever came with
it. Yeah, but it was there. Your book was at the Oscars.
I was at the Oscars, I mean, and I would think that in the back room, you know? But I was invited to do it, and I thought, oh, this is great. But I have to tell you, when you're invited, they also give a little cost for it.
Oh.
So I had to give something. But I said, I can't give you what you want. I have a little book. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. My book is not worth, you know, I don't pay that much. They gave me a huge reduction.
Wow.
And then, you know, I had to send some books, and that was how it went. And so I
That's
got
amazing,
to do it. But
though.
To be invited to do it, I consider it an honor.
For
oh,
sure.
Oh, absolutely.
That's who I am, this, you know.
Well, and Colleen,
That's
come
amazing.
On. Let's be serious. One of the actors who won an Oscar was carrying their Oscar and the bag with your book in it.
And somebody's read it out there.
For
sure.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. I love it. I think that's fantastic.
Well, thank you.
On a more serious note, that not that that wasn't serious, but on a more serious note, the book is a work of fiction. However, much truth is interwoven within it.
Correct.
Let's start with that. Could you explain what that means to the audience?
There's a lot of my life in the book. The young woman really represents me. Pretty much of what the young woman goes through, I would say 75% is my voice going through it in me.
Okay.
All right. The older woman in the book was a mystical woman. She wasn't someone that I actually sat and physically saw, but she was somebody that was extremely real to me. And when the voice would come, I would write. It was in my heart. I believe this was a gift given to me to write. And can I backtrack a little?
Absolutely.
I want to tell you how the book came to be.
Okay, please.
I found myself now a young single mom starting college. And my first quarter, I met a Lakota medicine man. His name was Charlie, and that's an important fact, so that's that part.
So keep Charlie in mind as the story progresses.
Keep Charlie in mind at this point. But now I'm out, and I'm struggling. I'm struggling with my faith. I'm struggling with my life. I'm struggling with everything.
Yeah.
And I'm going behind the college, and I'm praying, and I'm crying, and I'm saying, what do I do with my life? What do I do with my faith? What is there? And I could literally feel the life force of the tree. I was stopped. I could feel it, and it was like I was spoken to. And it said, basically, I had to lift up my branches. Mm. I had to learn to trust. My arms raised, and I remember it felt like garbage was being pulled from me.
Oh, wow.
And it was a real powerful moment to me. I mean, I was out there a bit. I'm giving you a very brief version.
Yeah.
But when I walked back into the school, I felt I would have glowed in the dark. But the first person I saw was Charlie.
Hmm.
And I told Charlie what happened. And he said, "Colleen, that is so powerful. I am giving you the name." And he said it in Lakota. And it meant tree-spirited woman.
Wow.
Okay. Now, I heard your speaker earlier speak about dreams and visions. Well, it was about a year, maybe 2 years later, I had a dream. As clear as I'm talking to you.
Mm.
And in the dream, it said, "You will write a book. It will be called Tree Spirited Woman. It will be in the cross between the style of Siddhartha and the prophet.
Mm.
It will be between a young woman and an older woman. It will all take place in the woods, but you have to grow into it." Now, I wasn't a writer. I was a reader. Yeah. Never thought I'd ever write anything. But that dream kept recurring, and it was like I had to do this.
There was no choice.
There was no choice.
It was just something that was welling up inside of you that
had
to come out.
To do it.
You were the conduit almost.
I was. Yeah. Exactly. And it was about 13 years later I started it.
13 years after the vision.
13 years later. But it, you know, I had it other times, but I knew I had to do it. I started writing and I brought it up to some people and they went, "Well, you're going to talk about this and this," and I just went and I literally got physically ill and never said a word to anybody. I just wrote. When the voice would come, I would write. It took me 8 years from the beginning to the end. And when you think that the book is just about 100 pages, you know that that was it. But life happened. I got other degrees. Things happened. But the voice, when it would come, it might be in the middle of the night, and I'd get up and I'd just go write. But I knew how it was supposed to be.
Hmm.
I knew what I needed to do. And so when I say I believe this book was a gift, I believe it was a gift.
Yeah.
That I had to do it. That is why it is done so well. It
absolutely
is sold just shy of 20,000 copies.
Wow.
It is done. It's a gift. And so that was part of the story and how it came to be.
It's a beautiful and another part of the story.
Thank you. And another part is every place that is visualized in the woods was somewhere I sat. Somewhere when I would close my eyes and I would put myself there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel it. And I think about writing some chapters, and I could, you know, reluctantly met at the beginning with Tree Spirited Woman, but a relationship builds.
Yeah.
And in the end, I could feel her touching my hands when I was, I mean, I remember writing that chapter and had tears and knew that I had to write this. And, but that when I did, when it was finally finishing, that that might be the end, and I wouldn't have her there. So maybe I put off those years.
Because you needed her in your life for a longer period of time.
Was it my grandmother's voice? Was it something else? I don't know. But I really believe that it was my dream that I had to do, my vision that had to be laid out there.
So this voice, really, do you believe it was the voice of the tree-spirited woman that was sharing this story with you?
I believe it was what I'm calling the tree-spirited woman,
Yeah.
I believe it was her voice. Could it have been my I don't know if it was my grandmother's or not.
Right.
It could have been.
Right.
But it was a voice. It would come. There were times I would wake up in the middle of the night with one sentence that had to be said. And I remember when I was writing and I said to my husband, "Gosh, I don't know what to say." And he goes, "Well, say this." And I looked at him. I said, "She would never talk like that." Because, you know, she had her voice. And that was her voice.
Yeah, and not your husband's voice.
And not her. So it's fair to not my voice. So it was her voice.
It's fair to say that your husband's voice is nowhere within this lovely book.
Exactly. The photograph on the cover was his.
Oh, that's very nice.
So he did take that photograph.
It's a photograph of a beautiful, I can't tell what kind of tree. It is an oak tree. With the branches spread wide, and it looks like it's just, like it's springtime and it's just coming into bloom.
Yes.
Oh, it's a great.
It's a new beginning.
It's a new beginning. I love that. Tell me where we can find this book, what's next on the horizon for this book, and just everything that I want to know about this book and how to read it.
You can buy it. You can go to my webpage, treespiritedwoman.com, and hit order this book.
Okay.
You can go to Amazon and order this book. It can be ordered from any bookstore. A number of gift shops, especially in the area, you know, carry it. Local bookstore, our bookstore in Stillwater carries it. El Fresco, a gift shop in town, carries it as well. So those are just a few of the places.
Yeah.
And when someone sits down to read it, I'm a believer that they will get the message they're to get at the moment they're reading. I have had some people that have had the book for 2 years and said, it just wasn't the time was right.
Mm-hmm.
I just took your book out and read this. Oh my gosh, the chapter on truth hit me so powerfully because of a situation I needed to have it. Or the chapter on death, or the chapter on, I've gotten letters from so many people thanking me and telling me that they heard that when they heard what they were supposed to hear at that time. And I think if you read it at different times,
different things will leap out.
Different things will leap out.
As meaningful.
It is not a heavy book. It is a very simplistically written book. The messages are short and maybe common things you've heard before, common sense, different things, but they are, the lessons are profound. Mm. And they're said in another way. And you know, we can hear something over and over and over, but one day you'll hear it one way or read it one way and you go, oh gosh, that makes sense.
That's true.
That's kind of the way this book will touch those. It'll go, wow, I understand that.
Yeah.
So.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming on Voices in the Valley to share about your experience learning about your Ojibwe heritage and also about Tree Spirited Woman. I've been speaking with Colleen Baldrica, author of Tree Spirited Woman, and we're very grateful for your time here today on Voices in the Valley.
This is Steph here on Voices in the Valley, and today I have the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing two gentlemen who know much about the St. Croix River and also boating on it. I have with me James Vukulich, who is an Ojibwe expert, here to help us with our Hush Sci-Fi project. And standing next to me on the other side is John
Kirschbaum.
John Kirschbaum, who is the owner of Gondola Romantica.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. And okay, he's got buongiorno here, and you can say...
Bonjour.
Bonjour. So James, let's actually start with you. Our purpose here today is we want to learn about navigating the river and how people might have done that and what things they needed to keep in mind to be safe as they went up and down the river. And we have on one side here with James the Ojibwe perspective of it. If we were here in the St. Croix Valley 200 years ago, we would see a very different scene than today with the big river boats and probably didn't even have a gondola. However, that said, in addition to canoes, there were some different ways of navigating the river. So maybe, James, we could start with you talking about the types of boats that the Ojibwe might have used on the river.
Certainly. Well, before Anishinaabeg, or that's what Ojibwe's call themselves, the Anishinaabeg, even went into the water, the whole process began with Semakewin, with offering tobacco. At that point, you're acknowledging the spirit in the water, and also you're praying for safety, because when you're out in the water, it can actually be very dangerous. If you're with your family, if the canoe, the jimon, were to tip over, then, you know, it could be, yeah, very dangerous for everyone involved. So it always begins with tobacco, with asking for help and acknowledging the spirit.
And then would they ride in a canoe?
They would, and our word for that is jimon. And that's a very old pre-contact term for canoe, is a jimon. Here they would probably use a weekwasi jimon, and that's a birch bark canoe. You would harvest the birch bark from the abundant forests were around and be able to use cedar to create a frame. And they would use black pitch. They would use pitch from trees and paint it black using charcoal and ash. And so that was, yeah, the Ojibwe's main mode of transportation on the water was the jimon.
And now let's switch to the gondola, because it's a semi-similarly shaped boat to a canoe, just a little bit longer with a little bit, well, peaks. I don't know quite what to call it, but yeah. Tell me about the gondola.
About 1,000 years ago, the small villages, that's now the coast of Italy, were easy prey to the Mongol kings coming by raiding and pillaging. And they got tired of it, so they built on the six islands in the lagoon that now makes up the Republic of Venetia. 1,000 years of history, 4.5 square miles. They were a major power back in the days. So you didn't mess with the Venetians. They had the largest navy in the world at the time, or at one point. A longest-standing democracy. Part of our democracy is based off their democracy. Their doge is the equivalent to our Senate. But these boats were made, so they had to develop boats to get in and out of the lagoon. So the lagoon was like 1.5 feet deep in water. So all these boats are flat-bottom boats, right? So they kind of evolved over time. The first boat that reference we have to a boat called the gondola is in the mid-1400s, a painting and a reference in some writings and stuff. And one of the last innovations they did to the gondolas in the late 1800s is they started making them asymmetrical in design. So the port side, left side's longer and rounder, starboard side's shorter and straighter, so the boat leans to the right. That does two things. Makes it easy to steer the boat, makes it so the boat will not flip over like a canoe. It's an ingenious design. Anytime you have a boat around for 1,000 years, they get it down. So that's going to be a big difference between a canoe. The other difference is canoes you paddle, where this boat is a rowing technique.
And I want to hear more about the rowing technique, but I understand, James, that there was also, in addition to paddling, another way that the canoe could be navigated up and down the river. Could you explain that?
Oh, gladly. And it's something that, as an Ojibwe person who's learned the language, we love. It's this word called gandikiige. Gandikiige. And that is actually poling a boat. So you get a long pole, and you use this to navigate through beds of wild rice, which would grow along in the St. Croix River.
And they were.
And so someone would be in the back of the boat, like a gondolier.
Yeah.
In our term word is gandikiige.
Yeah, I'm told the root word, I get asked all the time, what's the correct pronunciation, gondola or gondola or gondola? Gondola is, Americans tend to say gondola, Europeans tend to say gondola. Same word, same meaning. I'm told the root word is basket that holds things. That's why it's interesting that it's in the Ojibwe languages too. I'm surprised to hear that there was wild rice in the river. I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Could you speak more about wild rice in the river?
Wherever you would find Anishinaabe people, you're going to find wild rice. Anishinaabe had sown that seed anywhere they went. And on particular years, if the water conditions were right in any sort of lake, if it were like, I can't remember the exact amount of water, maybe a foot and a half to 3 feet is the perfect environment for wild rice to grow. So on a long river, in a big river like St. Croix, you might find some areas where you'll have strands of wild rice. And then to get to the wild rice, because it's in such a shallow environment, that's when you would use the poling technique. So you're pushing the canoe through the bed of wild rice, and you'd have someone knocking the rice into the canoe, like a basket.
Right.
And that's how they would harvest it. And we've been harvesting that way for literally millennia, thousands and thousands of years. It's the good seed. It's what's kept us alive for millennia.
So let me ask you this, specifically about navigating the currents of a river. What are some of the challenges that somebody who is, whether they're on a gondola or on a canoe, might face? We'll start with you, James.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I have as much information. I know that we have definite words in Ojibwe, like Nisachiwan, going downstream. And how to work with the river. So as your bimishka, which is really to, that word means to travel along.
Mm-hmm.
And then shka is like in the water, so that you're working with the river as you're navigating it. And we also had some techniques with sailing too, mm-hmm. with being able to, in a canoe, put up a little sail and have that help you along. So you're working both with the current and then with the wind as well, as this is navigating you through whatever body of water. It could be a great lake, it could be a river, or even a regular lake.
So you're working with the water.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that there's a way to go along with it rather than against, I think.
With instead of against, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, John, your turn with the gondola.
Well, my canoeing days, it was always the canoe's prayer, may the wind always be at your back.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work that way. But with like the canoe, we try to work with the weather as much as you can. Sometimes it's hard to avoid. You have to go where you're going, in my canoeing experience, a lot of times you just wait the wind out. You can't fight nature, you know. You've got to listen to what's going on around you and what's safe and what isn't safe. Depending on where your group at and where you're at. With the gondola, what affects us the most is the current, and the wind is even more than the current. If water's at flood stage, we're working harder. It's a flat bottom boat, so most of it's underneath us, but we're working harder, but we can go. There's a point where sometimes you're rowing and say, hey, I'm not getting very far here. The wind will affect us more. I can go comfortably out in 15 mile an hour winds. I've done more than that, but it kills you. We can get two people rowing these boats at a time, and sometimes we'll do that rather than canceling rides, get two people rowing the boat at the same time. But, you know, with the wind and the current, there's where you got most of the current. You're going to go to the other side of the river where you have less current to kind of scoot around it.
That's really interesting. Well, I think that's a great segue to take these Hush kids on the river. John has so graciously and generously offered to give all of the Hush students a little gondola ride to get the experience of what that might feel like. So John, thank you so much for that. And James Vugelich, Thank you for sharing your information with us and your experience and everything that you have done so far for the Hush team. We really appreciate it.
Apajigo miigwech bezdoig. Thank you all so much for listening.
I love that. Thank you.